Good morning, everyone. So my name is Naomi Nakayama. I think I met almost all of you by now. But yeah, Naomi Nakayama. I'm a Royal Society University Research Fellow based at Edinburgh, University of Edinburgh. Later this year, I'll be moving to Imperial College London. So I'm a developmental biologist who got sort of very much interested in actual morphogenesis event, which is very much mechanical process. And so I was calling myself a mechanical developmental biologist for a longest time. But then I realized that I actually like to learn about those making of a particular shape, because the shape means something, that organisms need to make a particular kind of a shape for some kind of reasons. So from there, since I started my own group about 5 years ago, I spent a lot of efforts and time in thinking, more than anything, about structural functional relationship. So when I saw the QBio title, a QBio summer school title, I just got really excited and I nicked it in my talk title. And especially because that Boris said at the very beginning of this workshop that what function bit is not as much covered, so I decided to talk mostly about that. Right. So I'm a self-confessed tree fetish. When I see any trees, especially the really awkwardly shaped one, I get really excited. So yeah, I love walking along the coastlines and things like that. And UC Santa Barbara campus has been great. I mean, there are so many magnificent, you know, old big trees which are really awkwardly shaped. And I have like hundreds of pictures, but I forgot the card reader, and suddenly I can't use it for my talk. But this campus has been wonderful. I've been enjoying walking around a lot. Sadly, I have to use stock images, but if you notice, a lot of trees out there, they're not like that stereotypical trees like a kid would draw, we put in our mental picture. They're not really straight up, you know, standing up vertically. They often are a little bit tilted, at least, yeah? And some of them are really awkwardly shaped, yes? So this is a famous cultivated forest in Poland. Something happened to them, and then just called the clocked tree forest in English. I'm sure in Polish it sounds differently, but yeah. When I see them, I keep thinking, like, why don't they break? You know, and also I just thinking like, ooh, I wonder which part is the most, you know, sort of where they are going out, basically. Like, yeah, which part, like, you know, this part probably, and on the bottom side over here. It's just, you know, like you can spend hours thinking about stuff like that. So some people just assume trees are trees, they just go with anything, and then they just stand, and then they can fix themselves, yeah? And very passive creature plants, that's some people think, but no, that ain't gonna do, because if you try to just stand just tilting ever so slightly for a really long time, you would realize your muscles start hard on one side. It's a lot of effort mechanically to keep that kind of a posture for a long time, and most of the trees are dealing with that. And they do that in part by a process called reaction wood formation. So that depending on the different kind of wood they make, the different groups of plants make different kind of wood. Hardwood species, they tended to make more wood on the tense side of the tilt. And then the softwood species like conifer, they tend to make more wood on the bottom side. And that sort of makes sense, right? Like to keep standing tilted, like you have to pull, you know, that much of sort of that body weight at the load. So it has to be hardwood. But if you have a softwood, then it's good for cushioning, yes? So There's a active mechanosensing and developmental decision making following that via the stem cell activity and the cell differentiation and so forth. And yeah, cell wall modification. So it's a quite a bit of an active process. And this reminds you, some people, of what happens with our body with bone. So wood is considered to be the structural element in plant's body, stem at least. And in our body, that would be bone. And the bones also remodel constantly. And then the more mechanical load, like, you know, mechanical demand you put onto it, it responds to change the bone shape and the strength. And that's why we do rehabilitation, yeah? Like if you lie on the bed for months, you lose the ability to carry your weight. But if you do the rehabilitation, you slowly put that ability back. And that is summarized in, now I guess controversial Wolf's law, but I don't think it's controversial to state that bones remodel depending on the mechanical demand they experience. So basically, living tissues dramatically, living structures, living architecture dramatically adjust their, you know, anatomy and morphology to maintain their structural integrity, so that you don't, you know, get fractured all the time. So yeah, there's a lot of sensing and a response going on in terms of mechanics in these trees too. But so to understand what that shape means, so they change the shape, but why, you know, why they change the shape is something that I really wanted to find out. To navigate my research toward, you know, development has so many different processes, which process I should focus analyzing, that I thought, you know, that functionally important bits of that process would be nice to work on. So when you think about function of a biological structure, any structure, often you analyze how it interacts with the environment, especially the fluid in the environment. So in this case, you would guess, so that on the coastal line, there's always wind kind of monodirectionally blowing over them. And that's why they kind of streamlined their structure such that they don't have to bend all the time, and they don't have to, you know, have as much drag sort of putting and pushing them all the time. Yeah, but to see that, you have to put this into the wind tunnel and visualize it. And it's quite hard to find that such a big wind tunnel. So trees might not be the best things to start with. And so yeah, so water is a fluid, also soil is a fluid, yes. So yeah, the fluid dynamics is intimately linked with the structural functional analysis of living organisms. So yes, so that we decided to start with something more tangible, but equally exciting. And that was dandelion fruit. Actually, it's not technically fruit, it's fruit and extra. So there's a seed and the fruit, well, yeah, seed and the fruit, and this appendages that they develop. And then it's often thought to act like a parachute, but it was kind of obvious to, you know, under closer inspection, it cannot act like parachute. So yes, what's happening? So these bits, that bundle of hairs, basically fine filaments, they are called the papas, and that's the drug enhancing apparatus this seed has. And it's one of the iconic flyer from nature, isn't it? Probably everybody have blown at you know, bunch of them at some point in your life. If you want to try, there are some dandelion ready for that right now on campus now too. But yeah, this is quite amazing. This entire structure, except for the seed, is a dead tissue. And it doesn't use any ATP in frying. It just catches wind, and they do it so well. So most of them would run within 5 meters or so away from the parents. But actually, some of them could travel 150 kilometers or more. It's just we don't know how to track them. That's basically it. So in Edinburgh, there are a couple of local dandelion enthusiasts, every city has. And they claim, so they can tell like subspecies of a dandelion, ecotypes and stuff like that. And they say, they really swear, we always, every year, get the Scandinavian dandelion. So like, all right then, yeah, we have to do the genomic analysis somehow. But anyway, so they fly really well, but how do they do that? So I said that they cannot act like a parachute, because when you look at the actual, you know, the papa structure, it's basically empty space. It's 90% or more empty space. You know, you do not, you know, jump off a cliff or plane with 90% empty parachute, would you? So each of them is a little, you know, quite intricate. It has, you know, a couple of cells, empty, dead, empty inside. Kind of, they are sort of arranged in a crisscross fashion, and they have a little protrusion, burbs sort of sticking out all the way along. And they do have interesting sort of spreads in the 3D, so those, you know, are great. And they radially expand. So we did the micro CT scan and get the geometry just in accurately. So number of filaments per papas is about 100 plus minus 9, 10. It's, by the way, really consistent. Like there are sort of records of publications from, you know, of counting papas filaments numbers from Japan, China, America. They usually always get about the same, 100 plus minus several. Lengths of filaments can vary depending on where they grow and so forth. But yeah, in our case, it was you know, about like 1.5 centimeter across diameter. Yeah, so that's that. And then angle of the filaments, you know, the filaments are kind of spread in 3D, as I said. And then filament spacing, as I said, they kind of radially expand. So right here in the middle, they are much more closer. So that, and then toward the outside, they are much more porous. And then I told you that if you want to know how the structure functions, you should see the fluid around it. So we built this bespoke tiny window tunnel, like that side. Yeah, that was enough for dandelion size, so yeah. And then, basically the fan needed to be so weak that we looked everywhere, and basically we are using a computer fan. So it's blowing straight in the air of about the same speed of how the dandelion is, you know, falling at the terminal velocity. And then, so we put the laser seat on, and you know, with a camera, sometimes high speed, sometimes just normal Canon, you know, this. And we captured the air movement around the papas. So this is a long exposure. Oops. So in a close, you know, blow up. Basically, what we are seeing is this is so in the middle, yeah, more or less the medial section. So the some airs are going through, right through the papas, but some airs are going around the papas and actually circulating like that. This side too, it's going around, circulating, and this is in 3D. It's almost like a halo. It's a ring. It's a ring of a wind wheel. Which is in fluid dynamics called the vortex ring. And this made my fluid mechanics research collaborator, Ignacio Maria Viola, also at Edinburgh, it's really excited because something like this was never seen in lab or in nature before. So it's not, it reminds, so vortex ring is quite common. But vortex ring tended to be attached. It's right above. So any kind of a 2D disk, if you put in, you can have a vortex ring forming right on it, but attached. But this one, it was detached. That's and apparently there was only one notion they could find in a book, theoretical fluid dynamics book, published in like 50 years ago or so, saying something like this might be possible, but Nah, it will be so unstable. It's virtually impossible. But actually, every single dandelion head that we, you know, dandelion seed we put in, boom, yeah, no fail, always there. Also, I should say that, no, what I was trying to say. Yeah, so separated vortex ring, and this was a sort of pointing to the fact that Pappus is acting as like a whole thing together, otherwise you don't have that, but also it's acting like individual filament too, because that's the two hypotheses that were kind of hanging around about the dandelion flight, that no, it's the fluid, you know, structure interaction at the filament level that's the important, no, it's about the whole thing. And then basically both of them are important, because without this flow through the filament, you wouldn't have this separation either. And this separation makes this quite stable, and it stays at a constant distance. And so you will see something like a vortex ring when you smoke, you know, if you're a smoker, you go like, and then, you know, you can create a ring, right? That's also quite common, but they always detach away. And so that something that's separated but stays at the constant speed was there.
Can you explain again which way is the vortex ring circulating?
Ah, yes, so we say this way. However, this might be going that way, you're thinking.
Yeah,
Yeah,
just
yeah.
to keep it bound,
Yeah,
because otherwise
yeah.
it wouldn't bar.
Yeah, so once, so you can increase the speed and they start to shed. In that case, it's kind of yeah going. I'm wondering if it's a little bit tilting toward that phase, but yeah. But actually, yeah, being this completely circling like that, to be honest with you, I'm not sure if we can say that at 150% confidence. Yes.
Given the radial symmetry of the seed, is it like a torus? How do you, or do you have cells? You hear this is a 2D section through a 3D. And so how would that be in 3D?
Oh, so in 3D, so this is a top-down
No,
view.
I'm talking about the vortex.
Vortex, oh, 3D, yeah. It's, sorry. We say, can you see this side? Maybe?
You could turn them away.
We are kind of saying something like this. Sort of,
Yes.
yeah, sort of going like that. It's a blob of.
So you have like a torus?
Yeah.
So now it's a test that is that supposed to provide lift?
Yes, so this is quite a bit of a discussion point. This creates a massive low pressure zone right above the structure. So by just, you know, theoretically, that Pappus and the seed would like to move toward it. But to design an experiment to get rid of this, to see how much of lift this is creating, has been one of the things that we keep thinking about, but don't really have a good idea. So if you have it, please, yes, let's discuss.
We look at weather patterns, so.
Oh, we do, by the way. Yes, it's coming. Yeah, okay.
Sorry,
yeah.
It would seem to me that you would want the flux to go from the seed upward. No?
Seed to
No, in the torus. In the,
Taurus. Oh, okay.
you put the arrow going down in this direction. So this is Boris's question. What was the answer?
Well, now you see there's a hyperbolic point at the bottom. You see this dark region right at the bottom? Right? So the flow, just as Naomi explained, the flow from the top is going down, but the flow below that point is going into it. And that's actually what's holding it together.
Okay.
So yeah, so by the way, having something like almost like imaginary hot air balloon, I come to you, yes, in this form of, you know, separated vortex, was also a new type of flight that nobody have ever seen either. So it's so it happens, yeah, it was a new type of flight mechanism too. Yes?
How high is the Reynolds number here?
It's about 100. So there's two different Reynolds sort of scheme. So each of the filament ones is very tiny. Like Reynolds one, 10, I think. And then the entire thing was about 130. But still very low Reynolds compared to what typically fluid mechanics researchers work on. But it's high for someone who work with cellular biology, fluid mechanics, yeah? Yes.
Does it change with the length of the filaments?
I have. I'll come to that.
Okay.
Okay. Right. So the having, you know, that hairy parachute, if you will, so enable the formation of SVR, separated vortex ring, and there was and it was counterintuitive, right? Hairy parachute. But seems like it's a nice strategy for a tiny structure that falls slowly, because having a lot of pores, when they're sort of in such a low Reynolds regime, you know, that sort of slow, tiny and slowly moving structures, actually they can effectively work like a membranous non-porous surface. That I mean that it's almost like if you imagine you have a strainer and you are pouring honey. So because they are traveling so slow and so tiny, so the air is almost like honey to us. It's so viscous. And then so the honey is not going to come out of those pores of a strainer that much, because basically the boundaries of different filaments, basically the drag from each of the filament interact with each other and basically create something called the wall effect. And so individual filament is this regime, and the entire pappus is about this regime, and up to certain porosity, you know, the lower side, it's basically same as impervious membrane. And dandelion pappus, for example, sits right here. If the speed goes up and up and up, then suddenly, yeah, it's going to go through completely, like, you know, there's no pappus whatsoever, right? So there's a sort of the regime that this mechanism works, and then it collapses beyond a certain speed. But dandelion, so it happens to be just in this scheme, right there toward the higher end. And you have to have the high enough porosity to have it get detached. So when we were doing lots of calculation, like wall effects and so on, we are just basically assuming there are 2D disks, the pappus, even though they have spread in 3D and so forth, that there are some literature about 2D disks, and some of them are porous. So we kept sort of simplifying. Let's assume they are like a 2D disk, because the 2D disk with a certain porosity could recapitulate that kind of flow behavior when we calculate it. But then, of course, you know, can we really say they are kind of like 2D disk? Is that the simplification we can do? So we tested the hypothesis. We made an artificial pappus with different porosity, and then just to sort of, you know, just to change the porosity. But the overall design is the same as pappus, yeah? It's a round 2D disk with a radially extending artificial filaments. By the way, making of these, so this is a silicon wafer. We cut with kind of an unusual way to create this sort of high porosity one was a pain. Our team, our collaboratory team, had a microfabrication expert, and he really fiddled with it. Actually, PI had to go into the clean room and do it. And we couldn't make 91% porosity. We just couldn't. The best we could do was 89. And so it was close enough. Well, we couldn't go beyond the dandelion porosity. But yeah, and they break so easily. So you have to admire dandelion, how they so easily make that pappus. And that is so they don't break so easily, yeah, but this one, if we touch, they just crumble, like 99% sort of the porosity one, which is this one. But, we characterize the flow behavior of an artificial purpose that has the same porosity, and sure enough, basically, SBR was found. And basically, their structure, so this is the z-axis sort of shape, and this is the x-axis, I guess, or the r-axis shape, and which was quite similar to the actual purpose. So maybe we can actually simplify. They are like 2D discs with, certain porosity, about 90%. And there's another way to characterize the flow behavior, sort of unique to the purpose, which was the transition from steady to unsteady vortex. So steady, we mean that the separated vortex ring, they stay there at a constant distance and so on. But at a certain speed, when we shift the speed, they start to shed, like how you can see it here. It's no longer like that, but it's just shedding like asymmetrically and with certain oscillation. And so we can identify for individual sort of a disk with different porosity when the shift happens. And for 89% disk, it was here. And for dandelion purpose, it was almost similar. And so, yeah, it seems like they are about similar sort of similar type of sort of. So we can say the dandelion purpose probably is indeed like a 2D disk with 90% porosity, and that's the important design features of the purpose for the fluid dynamics behavior. And when we look at dandelion purpose, the seed, in nature, its terminal velocity, they are in this regime. So steady, they can have a steady SVR, but it's really actually quite close to unsteady regime. Yeah? So that's where the plot thickens, because dandelion's parachute, the purpose, doesn't stay open all the time. When there is a lot of moisture in the air, they close. So this one is just purely in the lab. We put 1 microliter water drop, and then within like 10 minutes or so, they close like that. But in nature, if you live in a very foggy place like Edinburgh, or maybe Santa Barbara, in the morning, if you look at the dandelion, they look like this, yeah? There's enough. So we put them into, in this case, a moisture chamber, so just moisture kind of supplied in the air. It's not about the humidity, it's more like amount of water droplets in the air. Yeah? So they, within like 1 hour or so, they close to this configuration consistently. And it's completely reversible. They dry, open, they close when they're wet. So if you look at the flow behavior with a closed configuration, you do not have the SVR anymore, or like it's quite easy to shed. And falling velocity goes up. Falls much easier. And remember the diagram I was showing just right before, that steady to unsteady regime, yes? And now, because it's a little bit heavier with water droplets, and it's close, the disk size is smaller, and the porosity goes up a little, all those things together, and then also falling velocity changes, that basically it brings the dandelion seed from the steady, flight, steady SVR formation regime to unsteady. And all together, basically, when they're closed, they cannot fly as far at all. And also, we did another sort of window tunnel experiment. This one is much bigger window tunnel. We went to our collaborator in Glasgow, Alessandra, Angela, Hossein, and Mike. And they allow us to blow at our dandelion inflorescence and to do the detachment assay, because we had a hunch, and it was indeed true that actually when they're wet, that they don't detach that much. In the sort of a straightened flow, almost never, it didn't really detach at all. With the turbulent air, then some of them start to detach, but the detachment was very much affected as well. So our hypothesis or interpretation is that dandelion uses this morphing mechanism to sort of choose the timing of dispersal. Yeah? First, we thought when the air is wet, the wind is not so strong. So they are choosing for the stronger wind timing. Yeah. However, if it's all about wind, you don't really need this, right? When the wind is strong, they will detach, right? And then we did a lot of modeling, by the way. I didn't put into the talk, but we kind of collected past 30 years of sort of meteorological data from how many cities around the world, and we did the modeling of dispersal distance and things like that. We noticed that actually having this sort of morphing didn't really help them to travel further. The farthest traveling seed, the amount of it was pretty similar, even with or without this morphing mechanism. What was clear was, with morphing mechanism, they just tend to stay where they are or nearby. So our hypothesis now is, it's about, well, it's maybe it's not about flying as far as, you know, sort of finding the right time to fly as far as possible. It's more about dispersal is risky. If you're already in a nice habitat with a lot of water, then maybe it's better to stay in that kind of a habitat. And anyways, so that's that kind of possibly ecological significance that we are sort of proposing. And of course, we want to know what drives the morphing event itself. So it comes down to this structure at the bottom of the pappus, or center of the pappus, called the peruvianus. It looks like this. This is one filament. That's one filament, another one, yeah. So they're about like three rounds of filaments, spirally organized like that, yeah? And then on the bottom, there's a shriveled sort of spongy things you can see here. And top, so this is where the flowers used to be. So there's a nectary sort of remnants of it in there. So when they get wet, they change shape. So those are the filaments, and it moves. And so when it's dry, so by the way, this is a cut in the middle. There's an air hole in the middle. So that's the nectary, and then those are the filaments attached. And then, so the top half of this, so it's basically a gigantic spongy structure. Top half has the filaments attached to it. And the bottom half is sort of sticking up. And this is clearly, there's a huge crease in between the top half and the bottom half, which is lost when they get wet. They kind of pop out. And that brings the movement of filaments, just basically, yeah. So this configuration change moves the filaments going sideways to the top way. The filaments is a little bit funkily shaped, so it's actually not straight like that. It goes like that and up like that. So yeah, that changes the. So we characterize the expansion sort of a pattern, how the cell expand. By the way, we did the rigidity survey with atomic force microscopy for different parts of the pappus. There is a vasculature running through. There are five of them across this ring of spongy peruvianus structures, which doesn't expand so much. So this is the vasculature right here. Kind of, yeah, here and so forth. And there is a no, and then top the nectary structure, and then where the filaments is attached and so forth. But there's definitely the vasculature doesn't expand so much, and then the spongy tissues, all dead cells, these bits kind of expand the most to pop the crease out. There's an airspace, which doesn't really change that much either. So basically, everything else expands similarly. Vasculature doesn't. And we did the atomic force microscopy of rigidity, survey. They are basically similar, vasculature too. So it's about expandability when they get wet, yeah? And also, we looked at the direction of this sort of tissue by displacement, and then definitely it was very clear that some sort of tissue in the middle kind of goes down, especially toward the top part, maybe pulling the filament up a little bit, but mostly the tissue moves outward, sideways, to pop out the crease. And the expansion direction, anisotropy, basically is pointing that too. And interestingly, the surface area doesn't change almost at all for the top nectary bit and the side, top sort of the side, upper half of the side where the filaments are touched. And so different parts of the pelvinus expand differently. To different degree, and we want to know what is creating this differential sort of expansion. And we did look at the polymer composition a little bit. We tried to do chromatography. Of course, we need so much tissue that you can't get the cellular level resolution with that. And we tried Raman microscopy. A lot of cell walls are so similar we couldn't really figure out final sort of differences with Raman microscopy. We kind of went back to good old staining technique and went into the botany departments, lots of stain collection, and kind of start to use them. And some of them did show the interesting pattern. For example, the Sudan red that stains lipids, they really mark where the filaments attach, like very specifically. And also, autofluorescence that shifts from page 7 to 9 typically indicates there's a ferulic acid in plant cell wall that is found specifically in the nectary. And most of them are highly hydrophobic. So it's possible that the water is harder to go in from the top bits of the tissue. And we are trying to make sense of what would be the minimal design features that allow the pelvinus to act like this structure, hydroactuated hinge, to move the dandelion filaments. And we are collaborating with Alexei Gudoev, Anna Maria at Lyon, and doing a 2D finite element method. We are basically demarcated 1, 2, 3, 4 different domains of the structure, and basically trying out, okay, expandability, vasculature is different, but everywhere else the same, and water doesn't go in so much from the top, and et cetera. I would love to hear your theory about how this that movement can happen, but right now we are leaning toward this shape of a vasculature going sort of slanted. Probably is important because that changes the amount of spongy tissue, like so the bottom bits can expand or shrink more, whereas top bits cannot as much, and things like that. Yeah. So, and also we are doing 3D MIDI fabrication also to sort of, have a minimally sort of deconstructed hydroactuated hinge as well to validate our basic hypothesis driving from the model. So, in biological world, as well as in the engineering field, to move something that hinges, they tended to have this common themes of bilayer structure. One side expand more so that it moves that structure to move first way up, or you can, so petals, like, you know, expanding more on the upper side to open the flowers. That's a very classic example of bilayer structure. And also, even our arms moving this way, you know, this side is expanding more, this side is shrinking. So it's bilayer structure is everywhere. And then depending on the sort of little modification you make it to it, you can make all sorts of shapes just on the theme of bilayer. So this hinge, is it a bilayer structure? It kind of look like it, but maybe not a classic example of a bilayer. But yeah, this is something that we've been thinking a little bit about, where it fits into the sort of, you know, morphing mechanisms available out there. So we start to understand more and more about the relationship of form and function with this model of dandelion pappus. And we want to know, you know, we just were really sort of trying to find out what morphological features are the key, you know, conferring factor for their function. And so another group just published this really nice work, extending our study. They are the stability expert. They try to sort of see what numbers of pappus is the best optimal sort of number to achieve the stable SVR formation. And they looked at the different numbers and did all sorts of analysis theoretically. And so it happened, the 100 was the best. And so it was not surprising to us, right? Because we keep seeing the 100 pappus, so filaments in the pappus popping up all over the world. So yeah, so it seems to be that's the one that's important. Right.
Yeah. So is that number, or that optimal number, presumably would change depending on the morphology of the filament itself, their thickness and their porosity and
yeah.
Their length
and so on. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So this was based on the width of filament morphology that we measured, because they were not the experimentalists that they are using.
And are there any other cases of airborne seeds born at the pappus with different morphologies?
Yes, yeah, I haven't looked at it, but definitely. I will mention it a little bit in the, So how do the dandelion make pappus with 100 filaments, right? That's the question for morphogenesis enthusiasts like us. So pappus is a highly modified sepal or sepal, which is what Adrian talked about a lot on Friday. So in a typical flower, that's the leaf-like organs, outermost organ protecting the floral bud. Yeah? So they look completely differently, usually, from this. And typically, so Arabidopsis make four of them. Many other stereotypical flowers make five of them. But in the case of a dandelion flower, so this is a flower, very highly unusual. Yeah, so not just the sepal, but the entire flower is. But they make 100 of them, right? That's a huge shift in developmental mechanism. Okay. What they make also is a quite unusual cellular structure. It's lignified, it's empty inside, it's highly elongated, and the closest cell type I can think of in a normal plant's body is a wood cell. Yeah, and we also characterized the mechanical stiffness of the structure too, and the youngest modulus was about wood cell as well. So it's really hard, and then they are so hard, they don't even move, bend at all when they are flying. Yeah, it's really quite sort of a rigid structure. So making of a pappus, in this configuration, one can only sort of imagine how many runs loops, quite strong selection during the evolution that happening. However, Papa's, like, you know, that flying seeds with a bunch of hairs, Papa's like structures, is not unique to dandelion or their close relatives in daisy family. There are many of them in that family, they do that, but it has been independently evolving many times, at least 7 times, completely independently. And many of them look quite similar, like this fireweed, very similar, or cat's tail, very completely independent evolution of similar structures and strategy to fly. And they don't use sepals to make papas. So yeah, it's a little bit it makes you think it must be a quite tricky, a lot of sort of steps to evolve structures like that, but it seems to be sort of quite often happening. And yeah, and yeah, it's the sizes are sort of different, the porosities are different. By the way, smaller seeds tend to fly with hairs. And the larger seeds, like maples and stuff like that, they start to use wing. Yeah. So there's a size, kind of, dandelion is, according to our calculation, is the highest sort of edges of it. But however, a lot of those seeds are much larger than dandelion. So I feel like we are not getting to the bottom of this. Yeah. But anyways, so similar for insects too, the tiniest insects actually don't have a membranous wing. Like thrips, they have hairs and they fly. And that's probably easier for their muscle to deal with, yeah? But that enough creates enough lift for those tiny insects to fly. So there is a, you know, sort of, so the tinier things like cells, you know, they use cilias and stuff like that. So the smaller and smaller sort of organisms for their locomotions, the hairs or filaments seems to be kind of the choice of a structure to use. So hair-like structures are very common in the living world across the kingdoms and the scales. So there's just a bunch of sort of pictures, that illustrations from the book called Art Form in Nature, and Ernst Haeckel from turn of the century did a lot of drawing from all sorts of groups of phylogeny, and it really doesn't take so much of looking through his collection to find filamentous porous structure everywhere in the biological world. And the hair-like structures are, maybe it's not that surprising we find that many of them in nature, because they are very good, useful motor functional machines. Functional structures. So when they are alone, it's basically the best way, very effective way to increase the surface area. So it's good for chemical emission absorption, exchange of chemicals with the environment a lot. Water capture and absorption, they are very good at that too. Mechanosensing, they are very bendy, so that's very good, especially when they have a taper. It has a different sensitivity level of bending across the line. And some of them are very pointy, so it's good for defense too. So when they're alone like that, there are some, you know, functionalities, but when they come together, the functions they can confer just expands a lot too. They can reflect light, so lots of the grayish leaves you have in the Santa Barbara ecosystem, for example, many of them have either hair or wax that's shaped like a hair that's reflecting light, yeah? And as you know from Belclo, which was inspired by plant birth, you know, they are good at adhesion if the surface chemistry confers that. Also, they are good at packing because, you know, you can kind of pack them together. And they can lift water to keep the surface dry, or you can keep the water down to the surface, or you can navigate the flow, and some of which can confer thermal regulation. So this is not by any means exhaustive list. And that these functionality can be conferred at the same time with the same structure, or with they can change the sort of between the two just by changing the configuration, spacing, or shapes, ever so slightly, or surface chemistry, and so on. So it's probably quite useful flexible structure where the evolution can act upon very much. And so one function to another is not always trade-off in the hairy structures. So in case of dandelion, you saw the flight and also water, environmental sensing at the same time. And also they happen to be very good at water capturing. They, capture a little bit of mist, water droplets, quite well, and makes pearls of them along the bulbs you saw on the filaments, the tiny sort of protrusions. And we first thought, oh, that is fantastic. They capture the water, and then they use that to change the shape, and then that's really good system for water sensing, moisture sensing, right? But they don't really actually come down. They're very good at keeping water away, holding. So we are not really pursuing that line of kind of a claim. So what I'm trying to say is those multi-functionalities can be co-selected, but it could also be sometimes you see the function, but they are just kind of a piggyback. They might not have functional significance, and we have to be a bit careful about analyzing things like that. So this is something I really want pick your brain as well. So we looked at hair-like structures from across the kingdom, that biological realm, and we are kind of looking for the common features we can find in them, the design rules, if you will. And this is a graph of aspect ratio, so the length versus diameter. We kind of simplified all the data we could get, all the data we could find with this kind of data. In the literature, many of them are tapered, but we kind of assumed they are cylindrical because we didn't have the data about how tapered they are, so yes. And we plotted aspect ratio of the cylinder structure against the Cauchy number. Cauchy number is equations here, so more mathematically inclined audience out there. But basically, it is how flexibly it bends in the flow. And what we found was they kind of line up in one kind of graph. It's not surprising, the more higher the aspect ratio, the more bendy they are. Yes? We were expecting that is the case. But we thought it would be kind of everywhere. We didn't expect it kind of just have this common sort of one line that can capture them all. In case you're wondering, they're from animal kingdom, plant kingdom, and some of them are from the land. So the fluid they interact with is air. Some of them are aquatic, so it's underwater, which has been taken into consideration in Cauchy number. So without that it will be much more sort of scattered around. But when we kind of take all those things in consideration, they become this sort of a unified rule, if you will. And the Young's modulus is everywhere too, so it's from a very soft below 2 gigapascal to very stiff, above 10 gigapascal. It's everywhere, scattered around. So the question is, why should they have this rule? What does this mean? And it has been the question bugging us ever since we found this. Yes.
Sorry, I'm a little confused, right? Your Cauchy number depends on characteristic velocity of the flow.
Yeah.
And although I can't read, I assume these critters all exist in different environments, et cetera, yeah. et cetera. So you computed it with some characteristic velocity.
Yeah, and then, yeah. Typical velocity there, yeah. And then also the aquatic and then the, that.
And another thing, I guess, the vertical axis goes basically by 10 orders of magnitude, horizontal axis goes by 2, right? So that sort of looks like power law 5, but then I guess it doesn't really go by 10 orders, maybe by 8, so it's power law 5. What's the slope of that line? 4 or something?
Yeah.
Right, because definition of Cauchy, right, that there's this L to the third power, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Very naively, right, you would expect that it would be at least cubic, right?
Yeah.
But then the characteristic velocity might be changing with, in some systematic way, with the habitat, I don't know, right?
Yeah.
Right, it's some characteristic velocity is probably defined on the scale. But anyway. I'm just wondering how much of that power law can be explained
by the relationship. Exactly.
That formula.
Yeah. Quite a few people, including us, did a lot of that but also though in that case it might be much cleaner too. But it is rather sort of organically sort of the correlation is scattered. A bit as well.
So I guess the bottom line of my sort of real-time mumbling. it would be very useful to have a plot of U, right, measured as a function of L.
Or maybe a silly question. So you are looking at all these signs, assuming they're all meant to be, let's say, for air, right? Some of those are actually designed for floating in water. So maybe that sort of things fall apart.
I see, yeah. Floating on the water with a surface tension and things like that, By the way, Dandelion is very good at that too. Yes. that's true. That we have to tease out, But I think many of them are not doing the furs, the whiskers, and But yeah, we have to take that into consideration. So if you have some ideas or want to discuss, please come find me. And that's based on this kind of thing, that I'm quite interested in slender shaped hair-like structures, but not at the scales of hairs really, but also at the scales of entire field of cereal crops, for example, or forests, if you will, or they wouldn't have the same sets of functionalities like, you know, surface, the light reflections and things like that maybe, but a lot of the things that they would do with interaction with the fluids and so forth, or moisture controls and so forth would be a little bit similar, but at different scales. It has a sort of specific signature there as well. Basically plants are cylindrical and, you know, a bit tapered, and they are like gigantic hair. So, so that's where I can switch back to the wood formation, wood shape, plant shoot form and function from here. And so I hope it's a little bit sort of clear that what we are trying to do is by doing structural functional analysis, maybe we can, you know, zoom into the most critical design features in the morphogenic event that we could dig further into. And then that's the kind of things that we are trying to do. And for the plant shoot, how much time? I know we have 15 minutes, okay. So this part is a lot about what we are building up to. So so it will be quick. This is Arabidopsis, plants that this is normally grown. Forest of Arabidopsis, if you will. If you touch them every day for 10 seconds, like this, or 30 seconds, you can turn them grow like bonsai plants, basically. They really respond to mechanical stimulations, and they are shorter, maybe more branched, and then stiffer, and things like that. Basically, they are changing, you know, through the development of plasticity, ready for more mechanical stimulation, like what they have been primed for. So why do they do that? Why do they change their shape? That's something we want to know. And how do they, you know, shift the developmental mechanism to achieve that shape change? But also, Arabidopsis does make wood. It's an herb, annual herb. Most ecotypes are annual. But when they grow taller and heavier, they do make wood on the bottom of their stem. And now we can actually induce reaction wood in Arabidopsis. So it's a nice system to untangle that. The wood formation is a developmental biologist's dream. So the wood does not exist in the younger part of the plant stem. Yeah, the vascular bundles are separated, yes. And so the xylem, the water conducting tissues toward the inside, phloem, that transports nutrients, the photosynthesis, sugar, that kind of thing is toward the outside. And right in the middle, there's a bit of dormant stem cell which can become activated when they are, you know, the size increases, weight increases, but also when there is a mechanical stimulation or probably other physical stimulation too, like light, temperature, water availability, because wood formation shifts with that kind of environmental conditions too. But so when toward the bottom where the sort of first oldest part of the stem, when there's enough weight is there, or plants are old enough, they basically start to connect these two, activate that these stem cell population, become cambium, something called the cambium. They start to connect from each other. They are de-differentiating the differentiated cells in between. And to my knowledge, this is the only normal developmental mechanism, sort of processes in animals or plants that uses de-differentiation. But if you know other ones, please let me know too. I'm always looking for them. So they connect, and then from both sides, they keep making more of a phloem and a xylem, and the wood is the secondary xylem. Yes, that's the official definition of wood. The wood cells look like this from the side. So this is a transverse section, but from the side, they look like this, highly elongated, yeah, with lots of the pits for water transfer between the cells. They are dead at maturity. Their sole purpose is to transport water efficiently. They have lots of lignin that is hydrophobic, so it allows the water to slip through the tube efficiently and so on. They are stiff. They are, you know, that tube structure makes it mechanically quite robust as well. And so, the activation of a cambium is conferred by this particular kind of a hormone that is an amino acid derivative. It tended to have many functions throughout the plant body. Those of you who are not plant biologists in the audience, can you guess what it is? Auxin, yes, exactly. Auxin is a plant biologist's notch. So either you walk on it or you don't know, you walk on it yet. Yeah. Yes. So basically, yeah. Oh, also I forgot to say that, you know, the pappus with 100 filaments, yeah, that also has to start with the 100 spots of auxin maxima, yeah, from 5 to 100. That shift, you know, that's quite huge. So yeah. Anyways, so yeah, the auxin accumulates toward the bottom of the stem, and then that activates stem cell activity, which can be marked by Vox transcription factor, the homeodomain transcription factor activity, and then there is a specification of a xylem, and then cell wall modifications and cell death activations and all the things that happens, and that confers the stem strengthening at the end. So spatial specification bits and the material modification bits, and mechanical modification, the reaction wood formation seems to be acting on all the way through that this process, not just spatial specification. Auxin is important, but also for the material modification too.
Sorry, can you go back for a second? Can you comment on this extreme variability of cell size?
Oh, they hear. Or do you want to go one up? Here, like this versus that, or like within the xylem?
That's even more. So, is it just so the age, or they just we're getting a snapshot of some developmental time? So the lower ones.
So you mean comparing the young tissue versus here, or some of the cells in the young tissue is already quite large too.
Wait, I'm sorry, so where is young, where is old?
Young is this one, and then this is old. So this is young, and then this is old. So this is close to meristem, so it's younger part of the stem.
Okay.
And then, yeah, this was the first.
But now let's just talk about the young one, and so cells on the periphery are very much smaller than the one.
Cells at the periphery. Like,
yeah, just below the whatever the brown line.
Just below. Here. In the middle. Here.
Yeah.
Smaller than here, you mean?
Yeah.
So these guys are actually already a little bit like a supportive cells with a bit thicker second sort of additional layers of cell wall, and they are. So it's one type of cells that have a bit of supportive roles, and then that they are a bit smaller. But here, this is something called a piece, and they're ground cell that basically some people say they're just filling the space. It's watery, soft, and it's kind of gigantic, and actually they get flushed as the wood secondary from a xylem forms. Actually, they tend to get crushed, and then they're almost like a filler cell, if you will. But that's just the interpretation. What do you think that plant biologists in the audience? But yeah, the cells, there is a great variability in the cell size in this tissue, which is a nightmare. Because if we want to get at least one cell layer 3D stuck, some cells are so tiny, whereas some cells are gigantic and long, and then we ended up having have to do a really large 3D stack. That stem cell specification event. A stem cell activity of a cambium is complicated because it's bifacial, right? So on one side, they make one type of cell, a tissue with a couple of different cell types. Very different from on the other side, they make xylem cell, which also have very different shapes and functions and so on. And that same stem cell basically produces them. And then, so not surprisingly, there are a lot of cell-cell communication going on with receptor-like kinases, with peptide signals from one side, or hormones like auxin, prasinosteroids, galactone. They are all involved in the stem cell activity regulation, but as well as further downstream differentiation event too. And of course, the environmental signals can play roles in the regulation of these processes. And then the cell division pattern is also quite stereotypical. So it's a finely controlled. They tend to be always dividing in parallel to the surface, basically. Yeah. And that kind of cell division control also is via mechanical signaling, some people think, and also through that cell-cell communication mediated by chemicals. So to untangle that their sort of complicated decision-making processes, that it can be difficult to use tissue systems and just change the mechanical sort of stimulations, and it's just there are so much going on, and so that kind of reasons when you do, yeah, I start to think that we should also develop a single cellular system, and then single cells to differentiate them to become a particular cell type, and that's something that I'm going toward, and if I have time, I might talk a little bit too. So yeah, before I forget to say, so weight is sufficient to induce wood formation. So some quite a few many years ago, somebody just did this experiment to add weight of a much larger sized Arabidopsis plant, and that was enough to induce cambium activity and wood formation. And so your mechanical signal does play a role. But this was through, in their analysis, through fastened auxin transport through the stem. And so the mechanical sort of addition of the weight was enhancing the transportation activity of auxin. So auxin was accumulating on the bottom more efficiently, and that was their interpretation. But
in these plants, do they still grow to the same height even though they're under the heavier weight?
I don't know if they looked at that actually. My guess is probably not, because they actually decapitated the top of the plant as well. Yeah. And they supplied auxin or not supplied auxin. Auxin was made mostly in the shoot apex, so without the top, that they without auxin, they couldn't do this for wood formation, etc. So, good point. Yes.
Are they sure it was weight and not bending?
Yeah. So. They thought it was a weight, but you can see it's bending here, right? Yes. And so we did recapitulate these experiments in our own way. The way they grew plants was very unusual, so we don't get the same results. Yeah. And we also see wood enhancement, even auxin accumulates, you know, in the control too, but with a weight addition that we see enhancement too. But when we add the weight, that doesn't bend the plant, we don't see any effect. Yeah.
So, yeah, so that fits exactly with the classical literature on reaction. It doesn't.
Yeah, maybe it's not weight per se, it's the weight induced deformation.
But isn't even that, it's gravity.
The gravity. Well, but it's not inducing wood here, right? It's inducing here.
On which side there?
So the bending.
The downward side. Yeah. Well, it's tension wood, so it'd be on the upward side, you know, hard wood like this.
But in their case, it was old.
You take a willow branch and you bend it into a loop.
Yeah.
And you can bend it like this, and you get reaction wood on the bottom and then below up there. But if you put it on its side, the reaction wood's down here,
down there,
on the bottom.
Yeah, yeah,
Not where the tension is, but where gravity is.
That's true. Okay, so here too, but also you're expecting formation in the site of a bend and things like that.
Above there, they look.
But in their case, they did get pretty even, yeah? Like in their case, yes. But as I said, we can't quite recapitulate what they get exactly.
We should do the loop experiment.
Yes. We are doing all sorts of things
50 years ago.
To our plants that people are just laughing at us. Like we have a Christmas tree ornament type of sort of things.
It's all been done.
But it's quite difficult to pinpoint. Sometimes we see the effect, sometimes not. And there's a wind in the growth chambers and blah, 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 blah. It's been a nightmaric experiment. Students are not fond of. Yeah, so I'm not talking about those results, but anyways, so as I said, that the comparison of a single cellular system and then the tissue context would be really nice for, especially for mechanical treatment. I don't know about you guys in the audience, but for us, when we squeeze the entire tissue and see different effects on different parts and stuff, or the same effect on everywhere, we have to scratch our head a bit, because mechanics, you might be trying to, compress one side, but then nearby cells might be stretched. And then they are constantly exchanging, information molecules like auxins and things like that. It's often a little bit hard to sort of conclude on what mechanics caused what in which cell. So, yeah, the single cellular system and then controlling a mechanical treatment, knowing what you have done exactly, and then sort of put that into the tissue context, chemical, physical sort of stimulation to dissect it out would be very useful. And so from there, we have been trying synthetic biology, manipulation of plant single cells to recapitulate particular developmental cell differentiation pathways. In our case, of course, our start is the wood cell differentiation pathway. And basically what we do is we take a protoplast out of a normal plant. They, as soon as they get out of tissues by cell wall digestion, they lose identity mostly. They de-differentiate. And then from there, some of them start to divide again. They go through those stem cell-like phase and then start to divide again. And then from in these stages, you can actually, hopefully, that's the idea, to re-navigate them, to re-differentiate into particular kind of a cell type. And by the way, yeah, Arabidopsis protoplast isolated, if you have a very good hands, you can regenerate the entire plant out of a single cell. And so, yeah, we are setting up multi-step gene induction system to confer first cambium cell activity and then specific cell type of xylem Bessel cell specificity. And with master regulator transduction factor expression. And then maybe even the third step to manipulate a little bit of the cell differentiation pathway, like xylem cell die quite quickly, can we inhibit that a little bit longer and things like that. So, but when we, we are doing xylem cell culture. By the way, xylem cell culture has been possible to do just by expressing a homolog of this bind gene transcription factors in a couple of different species cell culture already. So it is a good a proof of concept. Type of cell line too. And yeah, we wanted to do that, and then soon we realized, ooh, this is going to be a very large construct with many transductional units. Like activation systems has two the transductional units, and if we are talking about two parallels and things like that, it's gonna go quite big, and then that's how we got into synthetic biology to begin with. So we ended up, and also there wasn't, back then, it was 4 years ago, we started, we didn't even have a two inducible system we use together. We are always one type. And so we have to kind of check the compatibility specificity of all those popularly used inducible systems as well. And then so we ended up making a whole bunch of synthetic biology tools, methods, and high throughput platforms to do this kind of work. Finding interesting behaviors of promoters and terminators and stuff like that. But anyways, we are getting to the point that where we actually can have those navigation of the cell differentiation. The cells are a little bit stressed out, so only some of them start to kind of have elongation phenotypes, and they don't do cell wall, secondary cell wall formation that well. So there are lots to troubleshoot still, but we are kind of getting to that way. And yeah, I think the time is up, so I'll stop here. But we do have a microfluidic system to squeeze them and give them specific peptide and things like that as well. So that's where how we are going there. Yes, I'd like to stop with the people. I'm going to talk about them later, the people in my group. But yes, we collaborate quite a lot with amazing people in Edinburgh and beyond. And today's talk had a collaboration with Enrico and Ignazio on the Dandelion project, as well as Lyon team, Arezzi and Maria Simone, and the Glasgow team, Alexander, Angela, Jose, and Mike. And Kahar was a postdoc who applied mathematician postdoc who did the flight analysis of the dandelion. Madi is a plant developmental biologist postdoc who did the morphing project. And Eric developed the microfluidic system. And Andreas and Jess are developing these cell differentiation, stem cell differentiation systems. And thank you very much for your audience.
In your cell culture system,
yes.
I was wondering, since in a normal situation, wood doesn't start to differentiate until a certain size of the organism and until a certain age of the organism.
No.
But your cell culture system suggests that there's no minimum chronology or minimum size of cells required.
Exactly.
That's not a very good
experience. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. It's actually, yeah, when you give a lot of auxin, for example, it can start. Yeah, exactly. Yes.
So also, when you do the protoplasts, you say they're de-differentiating. How do you define de-differentiation?
Yeah, I mean, that is a very tricky thing. I shouldn't use a word like de-differentiation too easily, but it's a one way to. So in this case, I'm saying that because a typical cell differentiation, cell type marker, gene expression, like ATML1 for the epidermal cell, they basically disappears within the first 24 hours.
Isn't there a Zinnia system for doing similar kind of things? So what are your specific goals of using this system?
This, for me, is using that sort of untangling which stages of the wood cell development, the mechanical cues affect their sort of differentiation and decision making. So Zinnia is a very specific system for this type of study, but Zinnia is a type of daisy plant, not much genetic resources and so on. But
you have a very nice physical model that explains the movement of the pappus in airstreams, but there's also a lot of genetic variation for pappus characteristics amongst the dandelion group. Can you use that sort of genetic variation to begin to tease out the contribution of different characters like angle, hardness, length, etc.?
Yeah, so the next step will be, I'm a much more, maybe immediate one, I want to look at those pappus that were developed independently in evolution to capture that design space, but for finer, like, yeah, sort of variations, which might give us much more conclusive conclusion, would be the ecotypes and the subspecies of dandelion. Yeah, absolutely. We have some really nice collection from far out island in Scotland. They have a really sort of unusual dandelion sort of collection in the island. So yes, so that we do have someday. We will know.
In the interest of time, we have to stop here. Let's thank you.